Hey, welcome to Life 2.0 Podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor. Try to make sense out of the senseless. And if at all possible, find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. Glad to have you joining me one more time on the Life 2.0 Podcast from anywhere and everywhere around planet Earth. Technology truly is amazing. Spent a couple days in Washington, D.C. and Arlington, Virginia. I'm going to talk about that in this show. And it was, this is what we call bittersweet, the definition really of bittersweet. The bitter part of it is having to say goodbye to a good friend and an American war hero. And an incredible human being, Captain Jerry Coffey, who passed away last November, but his burial was just this past week. And the sweet part of it is that getting to know this man over the last 20 plus years, 25 years probably, has been just a gift. End of story. I don't know anybody else like him. He was 7 years plus as a prisoner of war in Vietnam at the Hanoi Hilton. He comes out of that better and not bitter, writes a best-selling book called Beyond Survival, which everyone listening to this should buy. You can also get it on audio to hear Jerry recreate and recount his incredible journey. You can get that at Amazon. And the other part of the, I guess you could, you know, bordering on the sweet thing is to see so many people come and say goodbye to this man and the effect that one human being's life could have truly is a lesson for everybody. But before I get to that, I had never been to Arlington National Cemetery before. I've reached out to a few of my Coast Guard friends who have been there for burials and such and military honors, and they said, you got to kind of prepare yourself going in there. It's a bit overwhelming, especially if you're a military person. I don't know what it's like to go through on the tour that we took as someone who is not with a military background. For me, the minute I got on the tram and started going in there, I got all emotional. It's calling it the way it was. You know, we got in there and you start seeing these names after name after name. Over 400,000 men and women. It's their final resting place. And you see these just perfectly straight rows of white headstones with the names on them. Each one of those stones, by the way, weighs 230 pounds, which I found fascinating. It doesn't look like they would, but I have no idea how much is underground either. But it's just overwhelming. And taking the tour with the tram that we were on driving around, they made some stops and things like that. And the place was packed, first of all. There's school tours and trips and things like that going on. And part of me felt that maybe it's wasted on, you know, these were probably, I don't know, freshmen, sophomores in high school, eighth graders, seventh graders. You know, these are not real fully formed humans yet. So I don't know that they can grasp the enormity, except that they're just off, you know, from school another day and they're out running around outside. But I also know that you never know when a seed is going to be planted. If Jerry Coffey was about nothing else, he was about planting seeds in people and reminding them over and over again that they can grow something incredible with their lives. So as I watch 99.9% of these young people running around crazy and acting goofy and doing things that kids their age are supposed to do, there was one or two, three or four that were tuned right in to the place. And it was really interesting to watch that dynamic. So we took this tour and it stopped at all the notable places, except for one, the road that was leading to the Coast Guard Memorial was actually closed for construction, go figure. So I couldn't get over there. But other than that, it was, I'm still at a little bit of a loss for words. We just got back late last night and it was a very long day. It's delays here and there and stuff like that. But the first stop at JFK's resting spot with his eternal flame going, it's just, it's overwhelming. There's his name is there, and Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis is there, and you see this flame, and I kept having this image in my mind, you know, ever since he was placed in the ground there, of that flame never going out. Doesn't matter the weather, nothing. And I came away with this incredible sense of, for what? You know, I mean, look, I was a kid when he was assassinated in 1963. I have vivid memories of my grandfather, just who had just come from Sweden, you know, a couple decades earlier. And I was sitting on his knee as he watched the funeral procession for President Kennedy. And that's a lasting memory for me. When I get there and you see it up close and real, and his name is there, and all these people there, nobody talks. Very respectful of that. And just a little further down the grassy area, there's RFK, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who was also assassinated. And it just come away again with, for what? It just seems so senseless. And walked out of that and got back on the tour. And as we're going along, I'm getting the history of the place, which is an important thing. There's on the average of 25 burials performed every day. And this is a big place. This is over 620 acres of land. About 3 million people pass through the cemetery every year. And it is not only an incredible cemetery, a place of respect, but it's also a beautiful, beautiful place. There's over 8,000 trees there, some of them very, very old, hundreds of years old. And you see all the activity going on. You know, on one hand, you have this group of kids who are silly and laughing and goofing off and being herded like cats going to the next stop, walking around. And then you have people who you know, are there on a tour. It's part of their stops during the day when they're in Washington. And then you have someone like me who has, you know, spent time in the military. I'm there to attend a funeral for Captain Coffee. And, you know, everything in between. So I guess we all came away with our own perspective on the place. And for me, it was overwhelming in the sense that it's almost hard to describe the feeling I had there, besides this great sense of loss for all these lives. And that's just there, right? I mean, there's all those men and women who gave their lives all over the country and all over the world. So, but this, it's so concentrated. And it's row after row after row, and it's name after name after name, and it's just really, really a condensed version of our war history and the casualties and the utter cost of war, all the wars. And, you know, then I pull back and I keep thinking about the concept of war. You know, there are those who start wars rarely finish them, right? The guys up in the offices or in the Kremlins or the other parts of the world where they're making these decisions that cost thousands of lives. And it's hard not to pull back from that going, what does it really accomplish? And it's a loaded question, because obviously with the Civil War, it accomplished a great thing. There was much loss of life on both sides. But as it goes along, especially in Vietnam, you start to see nothing was accomplished there. Right. As we went past where the Afghanistan and Iraq war dead are buried, they talk about that being the saddest plot of land on earth. And you know, and so it's hard not to, at least for me, to try to muddle through. You know, when I open this show, I say, find sense in the senseless. This is a place I could not find any sense. It would seem senseless to me on one level that so many young men and women are buried there. And I can't find any sense in that. And yet the world is what it is because of their efforts. It's just a very, it's literally a two-edged sword. The second stop was even more overwhelming than the JFK thing. It was the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And that is guarded 24/7 by the best, most qualified members of the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment, also known as the Old Guard. Formed in 1784, the Old Guard is the oldest active duty infantry unit in the Army. And we got there just in time to actually see the changing of the guard, which they do every 30 minutes. And these kids are high and tight, brother. I'm here to tell you. I mean, when I was in boot camp, in Coast Guard boot camp in Alameda, California, I was on the rifle team. So we'd go out and do funerals and things like that. And I was part of that honor guard. That's nothing like this honor guard, that is for sure. It's the precision, the military bearing, the clarity is just awe-inspiring. And it's total silence. They ask us for silence, and they go back and forth, and they have the, you know, the changing of the guard, and there is the Tomb of the Unknown there. and you're overlooking this massive stone structure. And this has been going on. They've been guarded all this time. It is just, you know, this is the type of stuff I think is what should be on television more than the crap that's on there about how we're all divided. You know, standing there, we're all represented. Men, women, and children, black, red, yellow, and white, Democrat, Republican, or other, conservative, liberal, or whoever. Everybody there in mass watching this changing the guard. It was, again, as you can kind of tell, I'm usually not at a loss for words, but this was really something. And then we wrapped that day up and got ready for yesterday, which was the burial for Captain Coffee. And unfortunately, the weather wasn't like it was the first day, and it was a steady downpour. It was a soaking rain, one of these fairly cold, soaking spring rains in Washington. And, you know, we got in our cars and we went to the gravesite, and then they took Jerry's coffin and put it on the caisson with the horses and the honor guard and the whole drill. And I watched them come around to where the staging area would be for his burial. And then we all followed and walked up, and it was just trying to get just a tiny small bit of this man's life that I've known for so long, to see it culminate in all of this was also overwhelming, but it was also rejoicing. I mean, this is a guy who made a huge impact in the world after going through hell. Every time I sit in traffic here in Chicago, or I think I'm having a bad day, I think of Captain Coffee and the things he went through for 7 years at the Hanoi Hilton, and I've never had a hard day in my life. And that sense of perspective, I think, is what most has impressed me over the years as I've known him. So, interestingly enough, when I started in radio back in the 90s, there was a guy that came on more than a few times. Matter of fact, I was just going through tapes today looking for some stuff with Jerry that I did years ago, and I came across a couple tapes. This guy's name's Willie Jolly. And Willie Jolly, he cut promos for my shows back in the 90s and 2000s. And he was at the graveside giving remarks. And I couldn't quite see him because there was all these umbrellas and it was raining. And as soon as he started talking, I knew that was Willie Jolly. And this is a guy who I had never met in person in all these years. Now, I haven't heard from him for quite a long time. You know, everything, people find their own routes and go their own ways. But he's in the Speaker's Hall of Fame, and he's done some incredible things, and he and Jerry were very close friends. And I'm listening to him talk, and I'm closing my eyes, and Willie's talking about, you know, we all know the year that Jerry was born and the date, and we all now know the year and the date that Jerry died, but it's the dash in the middle that matters the most. And he expanded on that. It's a great message. And I think Jerry not only lived the dash, he defined how you live the dash. He defined the dash, something we should all aspire to. So I got a chance to say hi to Willie a little bit and spend a few minutes with Jerry's wife, Susan. And afterwards, we went to a home nearby for a bit of a reception. And there was a few guys there in their dress whites and a lot of Navy folks and a couple Army guys and all that type of stuff. And as we're walking into this home, I had my Coast Guard hat out and my air crew pin on. I rarely wear that, but for him, I wore it. And ended up in a conversation with Jerry's nephew and a young lieutenant. And Jerry's nephew was sharing how when he was a kid, he was able to climb up into the cockpit of Jerry's fighter plane. And it changed his life, and he became a Navy fighter pilot. So, you know, it's that ripple effect thing. All in all, it was, I've never had a higher honor. I've been honored with things, you know, titles and awards and all that crap, but I've never been felt so honored to be somewhere, to say farewell to a friend in the way that I had the opportunity to do just yesterday. And even though I've done this in the past, this is definitely bears repeating. So what I did, is I went in and I grabbed, I don't know, about 18 to 20 minutes of audio from a show that Jerry and I did 5 years ago when he was just 82 years young. And I recall clearly that we had actually already done a show. This is when I was with CBS. So you may hear some CBS marks in there, but I'd already done the show with Jerry and I shipped it off to New York to be processed and edited. And who knows what happened, but they lost the audio. It didn't turn out, something like that. So I had to call him back and he's in Hawaii on the beach with his family. And what does he do? But come back and he knocks it out of the park again. We did a whole nother show. These are back to back, literally. And I had such respect for that. He didn't have to do that. But he carried that torch of bringing the message all the time. So I could go on and on and on about this guy. And I thought it would be best for me to step off to the side and let you hear some of the conversation we had from 5 years ago. And then I'll come back and wrap it up in just a few minutes. And thrilled, really, for this show. I say this every week. I'm thrilled with all the people I get a chance to spend time with. But over the years, doing media for 2 decades now, basically, I'm asked every now and again of all the people that you spend time with and talked with and all the rest of that stuff, you know, who really is at the top of the list when it comes to the time, the energy, and the effort of the message that they put out? Really hard to determine that sometimes. As I think about the great voices and the great messages and the great people that I've been so very fortunate to spend time with. But I have to really kind of set it up at the top of the list. There's a fellow named Captain Jerry Coffey, who is the author of a book called Beyond Survival, Building on the Hard Times, a POW's Inspiring Story, one of the longest held prisoners of war in Vietnam. When I read this book many years ago, it just stayed with me. I think the first time that I learned about Jerry Coffey was a little cassette tape that Tony Robbins did an interview with him. I heard it in my car many, many years ago, and it had gone on since then. So when I got in radio in the middle to late 90s, I really wanted to have this conversation. We had some amazing, amazing connections over the years. And now that I've come back to CBS, where I started, actually, it was without any hesitation that I got a hold of Jerry late last year. We had a great conversation, and we were able to pull it off today, and he joins me. He's suffering, actually, in Hawaii on the beach. So, Jerry, thanks very much for being patient.
I'm getting the sand out of my toes here, John.
Yeah.
Focus more better. Hey, listen, it's good to be back in touch with you, my friend, and I'm looking forward to a working relationship here now and in the future. I understand that we've got some more time. We have to do a little more over again. That's no problem. I've got lots of time and ready to go here.
Well, I want to be...
I mentioned that I'm at the beach park at Kailua Beach on the windward side of Oahu. We live on the leeward side, and the windward side is the more tropical and damper side. And Kailua Beach is consistently rates as number 1, 2, or 3 by tourists and beach experts all over the world. And it's just a beautiful beach, and I've got my family down here. And not going to let a radio interview interfere with that beach time.
Well,
who says we can't do it all?
That's right. I mean, technology allows for just about everything. And in contrast to that, I'm on the 10th floor of the Prudential Building, overlooking a very soggy, cold, and wet lakefront in Chicago, and it almost looks like London outside. So you got what you got. I got what I got. And in the interest of full disclosure, I think it's important. This is part of, I think, the lesson of what you brought to the table, and always do. This is a restart. We had a serious technical snafu in the middle of 17 minutes in, and the computer shut down, locked up. I could do nothing. And so the engineer had to come in and figure it out, and took him time to get all that stuff. I called you a couple times, and it kind of reminded me of the lesson that maybe we should use as a leap off point. You know, there are things that are simply out of our control, and there's nothing I can do about it. Right? So I spend a little time reading your book a little bit more and just kind of biding time and checking in on you. And I think that's a prevalent message for today, because in the 21st century, Jerry, we want to control everything, and that's just not possible.
It certainly is, and we just have to prepare ourselves to be flexible and to roll with the punches when necessary, but also to turn the circumstances in our favor when we can. And that's what I was able to do to a great extent, based upon an answer to my prayers there in Vietnam, was to keep track of the lessons, the life lessons that I learned well enough to be able to pass them on after I came home. So it wouldn't just be a big void in my life of, you know, with no progress, but I could come home and capitalize on the experience.
I think that message right there, and I watched some of your videos to kind of catch up to speed to what you've been up to the last 4 decades, making this thing work, is I was so impressed. I'm impressed anyway, everything that you talk about, but in particular, you were giving a talk and you said, you know, even though my experience was Vietnam and my experience was being shot down and my experience was being a prisoner of war, all of us have our own experiences that we're supposed to extract the lessons from. And one of the most challenging thing I think it is for people is to have their perspective shift happen and get out of the woe is me and the kind of like, you know, look what I can do kind of thing. And so you were in. And I tell people this all the time, you know, it's very difficult for me to get upset with traffic when I think about you. Because what you went through, well, I mean, when you really think about it, it's like, really, my biggest thing today is I had to wait in line for 5 minutes?
Yeah, exactly. Like you say, at one time or another, we were all POWs. And I call it prisoners of woe. And we need to make those times moments of learning and overcoming adversity and patience. And the way to find the bright side of almost any experience. And, you know, some of my family call me Pollyanna, and that may be true in the most pure sense, but doggone it, I think, you know, we make or break our own feelings, and we decide what to do with them. My fellow speaker, W. Mitchell, a guy that's paraplegic, and I know you know his story too. You know, the title of his book is "It Isn't What Happens to You; It's What You Do About It."
Yeah,
and that what you do about it depends upon a mindset that you can live with way before the adversity hits.
1966, you're flying combat missions over North Vietnam. You're doing some recon in your RA-5C. You're downed by enemy fire. You and your co-pilot ejected out immediately. Took some heavy damage from that, and you were captured shortly after you hit the water. Eventually made it to Hanoi, where you were jailed in this French-built prison. 7 years, 9 days, you were held as a North Vietnamese prisoner of war. All the torture and the pain and the loneliness and all these elements that went into that most of us, if not all of us, except for you guys that were there, could ever possibly imagine what that feels like. And so I'm thinking, when your family's calling you Pollyanna, I'm like, well, that was okay. So that works then, right?
It does work. Yeah. And sometimes when they give me, you know, a look sideways glance, when I'm saying something particularly optimistic, I'm pulled up short sometimes, but I have to, you know, be conscious of what I do and how it's, I'm sorry, I'm distracted here. The Japanese tourists come over here and they rent bicycles. Mm. And a young lady just had a wreck on her bicycle in front of me here.
She all right?
Knee. I think she's going to be okay. Yeah, she's going to be okay.
She survived okay.
Yeah, right. Anyway, it's one of the favorite things for Japanese tourists to do, for any tourist, you know, come over and rent a bicycle and pedal through Kailua and then down to the beach park. And I don't know what caused her to topple over. I just heard her clatter to the bike clatter to the ground there, and she's on her way again now. So, but anyway, that's life, you know.
Yeah, right in front of you.
It's what you do about it.
That's right. You know, you just mentioned it, and it's interesting to me because we talk about perspective shifts in life, and a lot of us, we're not real good on history. I think, Jerry, most people think history started the day they were born, and they don't look any further back. But when you do take time to look further back, and, you know, you and I and Susan had this conversation not a couple of weeks ago about the deep lessons of Vietnam, how it is in a history book somewhere. And so in many ways, you are living history as a part of that time. And the lessons should not be forgotten because we keep repeating the same shit over and over again. And just that concept you said about a lot of Japanese tourists come and ride bikes, it's so interesting to me that 75 years ago, coming up this year, that Japan was our worst enemy, and now tourists come and ride bikes there.
I know. Isn't that something that's mind-boggling, really? And when we were in Japan, we were in Tokyo and then Hiroshima, and we went to the shrine at Hiroshima, And American tourists were lined up there to pay homage, just as the Japanese tourists line up to pay homage at Pearl Harbor on the Arizona Memorial. So it's a very strange set of circumstances and it doesn't matter whether you're American or Japanese. You know, we all have the same feelings and regrets and aspirations and the need to pay attention to our history. Well, you know, I'll just use my book as an example. It's carried by Amazon, and I go to the Amazon website, and I look at the feedback that my book elicits, and I probably have maybe close to 100 comments by readers, and at least 75 to 80% of them are five-star grades of my book, critiques of my book. And it's really gratifying to see that people are reading that book, and it's changing people's minds. Mm-hmm. But the feedback has just been so overwhelmingly positive and encouraging. I think I got one or two 4 stars, but mostly 5-star reviews, and it's very gratifying.
The book is called Beyond Survival: Building on the Hard Times, a POW's Inspiring Story, by Captain Jerry Coffey, retired, and. There are these certain chunks of the book that I've always been connected to more than anything else. And the first part I was just talking about how humans treat each other, and that even while you were confined in that cell, I mean, I remember we were talking earlier before we lost power about you being walking in that cell for the first time, and you had a decision to make. Were you going to be, because if you didn't make the decision to see this as an opportunity instead of always a liability, that you may never get out of there even mentally.
That's right, exactly. And when it became apparent how unique an experience it was going to be, particularly when seen through the eyes of the average American, I decided that I had to make the most of that as an opportunity and prepare a message for when I came home that would focus upon how tough we can be when we have to, and the differences between communism and democratic form of government. And when I shared that insight with Everett Alvarez, the first American shot down and was there at POW for almost 9 years, we were talking about what our responsibilities were going to be when we were released and came home. And he's been back in touch with me, and the conversation made a difference with him. And he's written at least 2 books, Orson Swindell, a Marine POW, mm-hmm. the same. John McCain had a chance to tell him what my sense of mission for that purpose, for that experience was. And recently, I solicited inputs from all three of those guys, and those are an integral part of the latest edition of Beyond Survival.
And Jerry, you know, again, all of us at some point, you said, are prisoners. We don't want to be prisoners of woe, but it's all about that perspective shift. And one of the things that is fascinating to me, because, you know, there I don't know the exact number of POWs in all the wars over the years, but man's inhumanity, man, always seems to show itself in the worst of times. But it's your ability and other men's ability and other prisoners of war's ability to not become totally bitter, to find ways to become better, even in the worst of times. And I kept thinking over the years, as long as I've known you, that you must have learned things about yourself that you never, ever thought you would ever learn or that you would need to learn. And maybe those things help you survive in some way, shape, or form that could never be predicted.
John, you're exactly right. I look at that POW experience for 7 years and 9 days as much more of a positive experience than a negative experience. I mean, what a rare opportunity to learn about yourself. I learned the value of solitude, for example, where you have nothing to do for days and days and days except look at your life, where you've been, the experiences you've had that you've accumulated, and how best to apply those to have a happy life. You know, we frequently beat up on ourselves for not making the goals we set for ourselves. But if you're alive, taking a breath in and out, it's a learning opportunity. Dennis Prager, yeah. The radio talk show host, he's my hero from a standpoint of his integrity mm-hmm. and his intellectual capacity. He said he wrote a book called Happiness is a Serious Problem. And in that book, he says that happiness is directly proportional to gratitude. happiness is directly proportional to gratitude.
Mm.
And, you know, that means so much to me because I have so much for which to be grateful.
Mm-hmm.
Susan and I have a wonderful life. All those years in prison, I could never even fantasize how good my life is going to be sometime after I was released.
Wow.
And we just live every day, for, you know, one right after the other, and are so appreciative of our blessings, our family. We have 10 great-grandchildren. No, not great-grandchildren. 10 terrific grandchildren and one great-grandchildren.
Yeah.
And we're so blessed in so many ways. And so, you know, in more ways than I can even count, those 7 years in prison has been made up for by what I've been able to do since I was released and the blessings that I've been able to enjoy.
There are two other pieces to this book that have always stuck with me. It is the concept of unity over self, that there is much more to us than meets the eye, and that in some way, shape, or form, that these challenges that show up in our life are really opportunities in disguise. And your faith, it's one thing to have faith and go to church, and that's all well and good. It's got its place. But I've always found faith to be hollow unless you actually have to live it. And then you get to define it for yourself. It's not in a Bible. It's not in a hymn. It's not in a song. It's not even in a prayer. It's something that's so personal and so relevant to your experience that it always becomes, you know, your route. And so I know that that has been the bedrock, that when it was all distilled down to it was, what's your faith, Jerry? And going from that point up is another one of those wings you discovered things about yourself, but then you started redefining your faith over a period of time, and then it just kind of launched you in a whole new stratosphere. So for people specifically who have lost their faith, because I've been there, we are all there at some point, what do you say to people when they get to the point where, you know, that seems like there's nothing else going on and that they've been forgotten?
Hey, John, you're so right. And, you know, the first two English words that I saw scratched on the wall of a cell by another American who had been in a little cell before me were two words with an equal sign between them. And that little formula simply said, God equals strength. And for me, that really worked. I was never, ever totally alone. I could always find a little bit more strength when I needed it. And that was certainly the key to my survival all those years. And you know, we just can't, if we have that feeling about spiritual faith and this and spiritual strength, we can't be embarrassed to share that, because it's a basic principle that just doesn't get shared enough, I think, for most of us. So, you know, I'm very close to the Lord and was all those years. I wasn't going into the experience, but that experience caused me to be much closer and more appreciative of my spiritual life.
Mm. Over the years, when you do these talks and outside of the book on Amazon and people responding to it that way, and I know that you've had the experience of veterans coming up to you, talking about what your words have done for them. And have you ever felt like, you know, the old saying, many are called but few are chosen, and that you and some and the guys that were in there, everybody has kind of taken in their own way, came out of that experience to, I mean, like that was almost like a setup in some way. So for the next 40 years, you could remind us that we can be better than we think we are. Do you ever think like that?
Yeah, I do. And I try to fulfill my personal role in that scheme of things. And that's really what got me through. You know, Viktor Frankl, in his book Man's Search for Meaning, had a similar insight, and he decided to survive that experience in a German concentration camp and all that went with it, so that he could come home and give the and tell that message to the world, what it was like and how he survived it. And I, you can be sure that was the first book I read after I got released and came home. And all the time I was reading it, I had been wishing that I'd read it before I went to Vietnam, because it was so pertinent and so helpful. But Man's Search for Meaning doesn't have to be a big, complicated and deep thing. It's all personal, and we can make that search in any different form that it happens to take, and make progress for meaning in our life. And when you get to the point that I am now, she's 82 years old, and it's hard to believe, to tell you the truth, but I found my meaning. And I don't mean to sound like, hey, I've got it made, I don't have to pay attention anymore, because I don't feel that way at all. It's an ongoing process, and it never stops. And I think that's an important lesson that I drew from my experience there. And I say there are heroes among us today that you don't recognize because you don't look any different as a hero. But I've been very conscious that I don't hold the premium for being a hero by any means. Hmm. It's in all of us, and we all have a chance for that to emerge.
The chapter that struck me the most in your book and the conversations that have been the most meaningful to me over the years, Jerry, is chapter 3 about forgiveness of oneself. And we are so hard on ourselves. We're supposed to be perfect. That's not possible. You know, here you are being interrogated and they're wanting information out of you and they're beating the shit out of you and they're doing all these horrible things. And at some point, stuff comes out that you're trained to not have it come out and that somehow you're a less of a human or a weaker man because you gave up basically nothing. But that tug of war that is in every human being, the black wolf and the white wolf that are fighting constantly for our attention, and that overriding thing that somehow forgiveness is for somebody else. I can't forgive myself because nobody else can. You've made that, to me, your main message.
John, it certainly is. And I have a conclusion that you can't forgive anybody unless you've already forgiven yourself. Self-forgiveness to me is very undersold. And it's not an issue that we tend to deal with. But really, to be able to forgive yourself, if you can't do that much, you're almost powerless. But to forgive yourself gives you practice in forgiving others as well. And forgiveness is so sacred and such a constant requirement to make positive steps forward is self-forgiveness so that you can forgive others too. But it has to start with yourself.
Well, listen,
let me just add quickly, John.
Sure.
And that means understanding our humanness. That, hey, listen, you know, I've done the best that I can, and that's all we can say, that's all we can do, is to do our best. And if that doesn't prove to be good enough, and then we have to focus upon the extenuating circumstances, which cause us to give up without doing our best.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're only human, and we can't expect ourselves to do more than to be superhuman necessarily, but forgiving ourselves is a very, very important factor in being able to forgive anybody else. I think that self-forgiveness is a key element to moving on with positive ambition and positive results. I was aware that several of my contemporaries there in Hanoi, other military officers who were POWs with me at the same time, came out with a bitter feeling about the whole experience. And those guys were not able to put any of it in a positive context. They looked at it as a waste of time and a big chunk of time out of their life and a loss that could never be recovered. And I felt so sorry for those guys who couldn't bring themselves to forgive our guards. You know, if you're released and you can't forgive them, you're continuing to give them control over you, which is the last thing that you want to do.
Mm.
For the person that you do forgive, you're giving up that control. You certainly you're putting it behind you. And that's really the secret to progress.
Well, listen, I want to thank you for sticking with us today and through all the ups and downs. I'm sure there were times when you were on the flight deck and you had to shut it down, right? So it's not so bad.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
That's
you
right.
Learn patience as a carrier aviator.
I was sitting here with my arms folded with all this machinery in my mouth going, it's a dead stick. I can't do anything about it. So there you go. The book is called Beyond Survival, Building on the Hard Times, a POW's Inspiring Story by my friend Jerry Coffey, Amazon.com. Jerry, I want to thank you again for taking the time. It's a privilege and a pleasure over the years to do these shows with you, because I guarantee you, once this gets out, once I fix all the glitches in here and I get it up on the air on CBS, when people hear this, lives change. And I look to myself and say, once again, go back to being imprisoned all those years, the message must continue. It is part of history, but it's still part of our living history. And if we don't learn from it, we end up repeating it. So thanks for stopping by and taking time today. Give my best to Susan and get back to the beach with your grandkids.
Amen, John. Thank you so much. And it's been really, really nice to be back in touch. And I look forward to getting together with you again in the future.
Be well. Thanks for listening. Safe travels. Keep the faith.